everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the assassinations of the Kennedy brothers, Robert Kennedy and John F. Kennedy, and the puppet masters behind them, then and today. My guest is Danny Sheehan, one of our nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. During the past 45 years, he has handled such public interest cases as the Pentagon Papers. We only think of Daniel Ellsberg, but had it not been for Danny Sheehan, there is doubt that the Pentagon Papers would ever have been published. The Watergate break-in, the Iran-Contra affair, and the murder of Karen Silkwood. He has represented victims of the Three Mile and nuclear disaster. He has fought against the American Nazi Party on hate crimes. He is the founder of the Christic Institute and the Romero Institute, the latter being a nonprofit public policy center in Santa Cruz, California. Danny has his law degree from Harvard University and later returned to study at the Harvard Divinity School. He is the author of The People's Advocate, and his websites are DannyIPSheehan, that's SHEEHAN.com, and RomeroInstitute.org. Nice to have you with us today, Danny.
Terrific, Gary. Glad to be here.
We have today the official Warren Commission, and thousands of scholars have reviewed it and found it wanting in completeness and accuracy. In the history of the American left's socio-political platform, a radical capitalist economic concept has been central to the Republican, neocon, and Blue Dog Democrat agenda, meaning they take how corporate interest, how the free market will maintain its supremacy above all else. Rather, today we are looking at something almost the same as the Poor People's Marches back in the 1960s, freedom movements. And at the heart of that was someone that the people believed in, and that was John F. Kennedy. And later, his brother Robert Kennedy, who was seeking the White House and probably would have won. Then there were social changes, and the Kennedys wanted to normalize relationships with our nation's enemies, particularly Cuba and the Soviet Union. In fact, President Kennedy had started his secret exchange with both Khrushchev and Fidel Castro, the latter through Vatican channels, if I'm not mistaken. Before we look at the assassinations of the Kennedy brothers, I think we need to look at this militarized industrial complex and the capitalist system behind it that owned it, that controlled it, and the influence they had over foreign and national policy. They were the unseen government, and they were the people responsible for the machine that became our foreign policy. And little has changed. We still have that same kind of machine today. $200 billion in arms sales since Obama was in office, and yet the world gave him the Nobel Peace Prize. How do you give someone a peace prize that gives $1 trillion for new nuclear weapons that does not cause the demilitarization of the world, but actually increases it and has engaged in more conflict areas around the world than any other president in American history? That is our conundrum today. So why don't you take us first, before we get to the specifics of JFK and Robert Kennedy's assassinations, and let's look at the ideology of private corporate governance back then. Who were the people? Name them, their corporations. And how did Kennedy fit into that mix?
Well, that's the critical issue, I think, that after having been drawn into the investigation, the actual real-time investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy, when, as I mentioned earlier in another show, that I was at Epley Bailey's law firm when we were retained to represent James McCord, the former CIA wiretap specialist who was arrested in the Watergate Hotel on June 17th of 1972 with the other Watergate burglars. And during the course of the investigation of that case, a professional investigation where I had 40 Class A licensed professional investigators at my disposal. We investigated that and ended up being told directly by Santos Trafficante, who was one of F. Lee Bailey's clients, that Trafficante is the one who had put together the assassination team for Richard Nixon back in 1960, in June and July of 1960, to assassinate Fidel Castro. And he told us directly that is the group that turned 180 degrees and killed President Kennedy. So I knew that in May of 1973, long before any of the establishment of a House Select Committee to reinvestigate the assassination, before the Church Committee hearings or anything. So I began a professional investigation at that time to determine whether we could confirm that information, and we clearly did. And this all led back to a major power group that was headed up basically by Alan Dulles, who was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency when Richard Nixon was the vice president, when he created this assassination team. And we came to realize that this assassination team, this group of 15 anti-Castro, Miami-based anti-Castro Cubans, exiles, that this group had actually assassinated President Kennedy. But Santos Trafficante tried to convince us that they had done this on their own, or to exonerate himself, at least. But it became clear from my continued investigations of this, I interviewed Richard Billings, who was the Life magazine bureau chief in Miami, who in fact had been on board a major yacht in 1963 in June, when in fact this fellow Rip Robertson, William Rip Robertson, who was the field commander for the assassination team, was sending in a group into Cuba to try to assassinate Castro, and Dick Billings stood on the deck of the yacht of William D. Pauley, a very wealthy Miami businessman, who said, "We're going to kill the president." And he was right there running the assassination team at the time. So I continued that investigation and was able to confirm, to my satisfaction as a professional investigator and attorney, that the team had been actually authorized to kill the president by Alan Dulles. And there was a small group of men around him, Bill Harvey and Theodore Shackley and a handful of other men, who in fact had been given the green light through Alan Dulles. And it's important for everybody who's listening to remember and to know that Alan Dulles was the legal counsel for Brown Brothers Harriman, which was in fact a major private investment firm that had some 60 men who were the CEOs and major owners of 50 of the major corporations in the world. They're everything from David Rockefeller to his son Nelson Rockefeller to Peter Grace from the Grace W.R. Grace Corporation almost every single major private business corporate owner sat on that investment group, and their attorney was Alan Dulles. And the CEO for that particular organization, Brown Brothers Harriman, was George Herbert Walker, who, most people think that you're just making fun of George H.W. Bush whenever we referred to him as George Herbert Walker Bush, just trying to give people the impression he was from some snooty, wealthy family. But George Herbert Walker was the chairman and CEO of Brown Brothers Harriman, that had all of these men sitting at the table making these major investment decisions. And it became clear to us from our investigation that Kennedy, from the time of the Bay, not the Bay of Pigs invasion, which most people get confused about, but from the Cuban Missile Crisis that took place in October of 1962, from the night of October 26th, when he was told that the Joint Chiefs of Staff had voted unanimously to invade Cuba, even though they knew that that was going to trigger a nuclear exchange between the Soviet Union and the United States, President Kennedy on that night, I became totally convinced as the attorney in charge of that investigation that, in fact, President Kennedy had gone through what we call a metanoia, an experience, a totally transformative experience, which caused him to initiate a major set of steps, that one of which, and the most important of which, was that he began a series of totally confidential exchanges of letters with Nikita Khrushchev, some 18 letters that were carried by Norman Cousins, a man who was in direct communication with Pope John the 23rd. And they were, Nikita Khrushchev and President John Kennedy, were negotiating the elimination, a total elimination of all of the nuclear warheads of both the Soviet Union and the United States. And when that information was found out about by Alan Dulles, that is clear to me that he communicated that to these men sitting around that table, some 60 men. And we have the direct testimony of James Jesus Angleton, who was personally retained by Alan Dulles, in Dulles' capacity as the director of the CIA. When James Jesus Angleton was hired by Dulles to be the chief of counterintelligence for the CIA, that he was told by Alan Dulles, the sole condition on which I'm hiring you is that you never submit me to a lie detector test or the other 60 men that worked with me to help fund the rise of Germany after the end of World War One, before World War Two, when they set up this bank that financed the rise of Hitler. They've established Hitler in Germany as, in fact, the bulwark against Bolshevism in Europe. And that's the key group of people. And they thought that they could depend upon John Kennedy, because John Kennedy's father, Joseph Kennedy, had been sympathetic to Hitler. In fact, had to be removed from his position as the United States ambassador to the United Kingdom because of his support for Hitler. And in fact, John Kennedy, much to everyone's surprise, which they don't know about actually, handwrote in his own personal diary in his junior year at Harvard College in 1939 that he had gone to Germany with his father after having gone to Rome to be present for the appointment, basically the election of Pope Pius XII was being inaugurated, and they went to his inauguration, and they went to Germany, and John Kennedy handwrote into his own diary that he thought that Hitler was very good for Germany, and that it was appropriate to have him be the chancellor. And we found out that on January 3rd of 1933, that Alan Dulles sat in a personal meeting with Adolf Hitler at the home of his private banker, Hitler's private banker, and that they agreed in that meeting to have Hitler become the Chancellor of Germany as long as he would agree to pay the loans that had been extended to Germany by the private business clients of Brown Brothers Harriman. So we know that that all happened. So when I was there in 1973 at F. Lee Bailey's office, I was completely thunderstruck that we were able to determine with absolute clarity who it was that killed the president, why they killed him, and the direct role of Alan Dulles in supervising those people, because we ended up getting photographs of Rip Robertson standing right directly in Dealey Plaza, right next to the famous throughway sign, where he was standing there. There's a photograph of him standing on the curbstone, tipping his hat to President Kennedy 1.2 seconds before the first shot rang out and that shot the president. And he was the head of the assassination team, this 15-man assassination team that was codenamed the S-Force. And that was all directly under the supervision of Theodore G. Shackley, who was the Miami station chief of the CIA. It was working directly with Bill Harvey and two other people that were there in that office. And that's what we were able to find out. And I, upon discovering that, said, look, this was information that I had developed in the office as a lawyer representing a client And so I had to deal with the question of being able to convey this to other people. And so I ended up eventually telling this. I told this, for example, to Tip O'Neill, who was the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the Democratic Speaker of the House of Representatives. We told this to the head of the Judiciary Committee, Peter Rodino, who has the responsibility to investigate things like this. You know, we have shared this with the Justice Department. Nobody wants to do anything about this. Very similar to the decision that you heard this morning with regard to Hillary Clinton, where there were determinations made that she had been reckless and careless in her handling of these emails, and the former U.S. prosecutors would say when they were being interviewed this morning that if in fact this had been an assistant secretary of state or even like that, this fellow David Rifkin, a former United States Justice Department official, said that if in fact this had been an assistant secretary of state or any military person who had conducted themselves like this, it was virtually certain that they would be criminally prosecuted. But in fact, the decision was made not to prosecute her because she was going to become the Democratic nominee for president, and that the FBI has a policy of not interfering in the political power structures of the American government. This was exactly what they said during the Iran-Contra investigation when Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh tried to prosecute the top-level officials of the Reagan and Bush administration, and that we were later told, actually it was Cy Hirsch, was told directly by the heads of the investigation that they didn't want to investigate the charges that were being made by the Christic Institute at that time, because they said this was a very sensitive period when the Soviet Union was dissolving, and they did not want to destabilize the American administration at such a sensitive time in history, basically acknowledging that they would have had to criminally indict these people, but they wouldn't do it because of the political power that those people possessed. And that has been the way it is, that the people who sat around that table at Brown Brothers Harriman were major people who rolled in and out of the American government. They were secretaries of the Treasury and secretaries of defense, and they held various secretarial posts. You know, for example, Robert Lovett was a senior partner of Brown Brothers Harriman. He had been made an assistant secretary of defense, or Secretary of War at that time, under Henry Stimson. He, in fact, was the Secretary of the Treasury. He'd been an Assistant Secretary of the Navy. That these huge businessmen are appointed in high-level government positions, and they go back and forth with a so-called, you know, rolling, this swinging door. And that's the problem. There's a complete double standard about who is going to be prosecuted for criminal wrongdoing. And this is the challenge that we have. And at the core of the Kennedy assassination, when that's investigated, I have established myself that it's possible for a professional investigator, a trained attorney, to find direct evidence that would criminally prosecute and convict these people of the crime. But the Justice Department, both under Republicans and Democrats, refuses to conduct that investigation, even when, in fact, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, in their final report, written by G. Robert Blakey and this man Richard Billings, said specifically that we find, by the clear evidence, that it's more probable than not that President Kennedy was killed as a result of a conspiracy. And in fact, the most likely suspects in that conspiracy were a certain element of Miami-based anti-Castro Cuban exiles and a certain element of organized crime. I know exactly who those certain anti-Castro Cubans were. You know, Rafael Chichi Quintero, Ricardo Chavez, Felix Rodriguez, Ricardo Martinez, all these, that we know who these people were, and we have the photographs of their field commander, Rip Robertson, standing right in Dealey Plaza, giving the signal, tipping the hat at the president to kill the president. And we know that Edward Lansdale was right there in Dealey Plaza. We have two photographs of him standing in Dealey Plaza right at that time. Out of a 4-mile caravan of the president coming from Love Field all the way to where he was going to be speaking, they happened to be standing right in that particular plaza, right there where the president was killed at that time. That any investigative attorney and any prosecuting attorney knows full well that there's not 1 in 10 million billion chances that that was a coincidence.
Okay, let's look at how they did it. Do you know the shooters? Were any of the people, based upon previous discussions, Mark Lane and Executive Action, the film that Warren Beatty was in, were those pure fiction, partially? The different books written on this, there have been over 1,000, 1,500 books written on this.
Yeah.
How many got it right? Because I'm not aware of any that have told the story that you're telling. And were there backup teams to kill the people who killed the president so that there'd be no one talking, or did they all get away with it? And who was involved in the cover-up?
Yes, no, the taking them in reverse order, in fact, they did not kill them. Felix Rodriguez lived all the way until recently. Rafael Chichi Quintero was alive. The actual trigger man was David Morales. They nicknamed him the Mexican, but he in fact was the trigger man. They had a 15-man unit that was there, you know, spotters and everyone else, and they did not kill these people. And in fact, the people that were coordinating them was E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis, who later on were directly involved in the Watergate break-in in June of 1972, almost 10 years later, because they were terrified. Richard Nixon had become terrified that that the new head of the Democratic National Committee, Larry O'Brien, who had long involved story, but they had fears that he had found out about this. And so they wiretapped his office and wiretapped his telephone in order to determine whether or not he knew about this and was going to be using it against Nixon in the 1972 campaign, because Nixon by that time had come in to being the Democrat or being the Republican nominee for president. So that they didn't kill these people at all. And what's happened is a lot of people who are not full professional investigators who have no experience actually investigating real conspiracies or real criminal enterprises, what they do is they speculate, and their speculation is usually motivated by their own political worldview, and so that they project onto pieces of information. They, you know, they add up 2 and 2 and get 22. But, you know, you have to take these investigations one step at a time, and you have to make clear determinations. My investigators use psychological stress evaluators, PSEs, the most sophisticated type of lie detector equipment. It's not like wiring you up to something to check your breath. You know, this is an extraordinarily sophisticated system that is able to register the tension in the vocal cords of a person answering the questions. We have people who have access to all the most sophisticated laboratories. We conducted this investigation and came to this conclusion. And I was in the difficult position of being in a law firm that had gained this information in the context of a private investigation. But when I ended up leaving, I left F. Lee Bailey's office specifically because of that. I did not want to remain constrained in that way. And so what we did is we put this information into a major affidavit, a good deal of it, when we prosecuted a number of these same people during the Iran-Contra investigation. Theodore Shackley, who was the principal defendant in the Iran-Contra case, not Oliver North and not just Richard Secord, but Theodore G. Shackley, turns out to be the exact same guy that was the Miami station chief in Miami in 1963. And in fact, he personally drove a car with a trailer with the rifles that were being delivered to that assassination team for them to use in political assassinations. We know that they were trained on the ranch down in Oaxaca, Mexico, that was owned by the fellow whose father owned the Dallas Texans. Clint Murchison Jr. owned the ranch in Oaxaca, Mexico. That's where they were trained. They were one of their major trainers in the field was this guy William Rip Robertson, along with a guy named Carl Jenkins. I've spent you know, entire afternoon sitting in the safe house with Carl Jenkins out in Virginia, debriefing him, you know, on lots of this assassination activities, et cetera. You know, so I know that this stuff is true. And the fact of the matter is there is no statute of limitation on a murder like that. And so the fact of the matter is that the Justice Department that is coming in the next administration is just as duty-bound to investigate this murder of the president as the administration that was in power in 1963. So this thing has not gone away. This is not an old story. This is not something that is past. This is something that happened right on our own watch. The members of the baby boom generation who came to adulthood at the time of this assassination, we have responsibility for bringing these people to justice. Those of them that are still alive, and there are some that are still alive, that Carl Jenkins should be subpoenaed. We know right where he is. We know where to get him. Any Justice Department that makes the decision to undertake a genuine investigation in this case can prove this case still, and that there are people alive today who can testify personally about this. So this is, we only have a short amount of time. Within another 8 to 10 years, all of these people will be dead. And that's what they're hoping for, is that they don't have to knock off the people that did this. All they have to do is wait out their natural deaths. And that's the situation that we're faced with now. So
we're in
the 11th hour
of this
investigation.
Yeah. Danny, who engaged in the cover-up?
Well, clearly the most important person that engaged in the cover-up was Lyndon Johnson. And he brought in Alan Dulles, the former head of the Central Intelligence Agency, that in fact was the field commander for the very assassination team itself, to be the principal person in the commission. And then Lyndon Johnson went to the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Earl Warren, and asked Earl Warren to chair the committee, the Assassination Review Committee, so that it could be having the prestige of the Supreme Court and the alleged objectivity. And when Warren refused to do it, saying he thought that was totally inappropriate to conflate the prestige of the Supreme Court with a criminal investigation like this, Lyndon Johnson told him directly, said, Earl, look it, the fact is that there was an assassination team that was fielded to assassinate Fidel Castro. And then he lied to Warren and said, and that assassination team was put together by John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy to kill Castro. And if that comes out and is ever made public, the American people are going to think that Fidel Castro found out about that, retaliated by killing President Kennedy, and then we're going to have to be forced to invade Cuba, and there's going to be a third world war with Russia. So you have to, among all things, chair this commission and conceal the existence of the assassination team that was put together to assassinate Fidel Castro. That's what you're there to do. And Alan Dulles is the one, the only one on the commission that attended every single one of the hearings and every single one of the depositions. He's the guy that rode shotgun on this thing as the former Central Intelligence Agency director, but more importantly, as in fact the consiglieri for Brown Brothers Harriman and those 60 men who in fact had worked with Alan Dulles to help fund the rise of the Third Reich in Germany as the bulwark against Bolshevism in Europe. That's who these people are. So what we're dealing with is a major fascist group. And you get people like J. Edgar Hoover at the head of the FBI. They put together an investigation that was clearly not designed to find out what had really happened. It was clearly designed simply to lay the blame right at the feet of Lee Harvey Oswald, acting completely by himself. And then they, in fact, assigned that investigation over to the House Select Committee on Assassinations that worked for the following year. And the committee did nothing but attempt to confirm that two-week investigation that the FBI had done. And that they coerced witnesses, they ignored witnesses. There are lists of dozens and dozens of eyewitnesses who have evidence that put in front of any jury in the world would lead to the conclusion that this was a full-scale conspiracy to kill the president. But they were ignored completely. They refused to investigate them. They refused to interview them. You can see in the interrogations of some of the witnesses. They were trying to direct the witnesses' testimony. They were trying to bully them and browbeat them into retracting their sworn statements about evidence that was leading to a conspiracy. That this cover-up that was engaged in, led by Lyndon Johnson, and more or less unwittingly by Earl Warren, but very consciously by Alan Dulles, was also participated in, of course, by Gerald Ford, who was another person that was on the commission. And that's why, when Richard Nixon felt that he was under pressure for the Watergate burglary in 1972, that he ended up, you know, getting rid of Spiro T. Agnew as his vice president and brought in Gerald Ford, another one of the fix-it guys who'd been on the Warren Commission, brought him in as his vice president so that when Richard Nixon resigned, that in fact Gerald Ford came in and immediately pardoned him, and he hadn't even been indicted yet. So this cabal of people that are involved in the cover-up are transparent and obvious of who these people were. And the fact is that none of the media would challenge that. None of the media would say, what in the world is Alan Dulles running this commission? He just got fired by Kennedy, you know, for trying to lure Kennedy into sending in U.S. military forces into Cuba. What in the world is he doing, heading this thing up? And the fact is that over 65% of all of the people in the United States right now are absolutely clear that Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill the president acting alone, but that in fact there was a conspiracy there. And the majority of those people don't even believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was directly involved at shooting at the president, for lots of good reasons, which had to do with ballistics and the testing of the bullets that were removed from the president. And then, of course, these 1,500 books that have been written about the Kennedy assassination probe into almost every aspect of the assassination, having to do with the falsification of autopsy information, the falsification of evidence relating to the finding of the weapons, etc. But the fact of the matter is, if there was a bona fide investigation by the United States Justice Department right now, under the upcoming Hillary Clinton administration, as distasteful as people may find that, having to come to grips with the reality that that's what's getting ready to happen, if massive pressure were put on to insist that the Justice Department conduct a thorough investigation, or for that matter, if some wealthy group of people came together and put together a bona fide investigative fund, that this investigation could be conducted and a civil litigation could be conducted that would be as successful as the Karen Silkwood case, that we ended up winning a $10.5 million judgment against the people that killed Karen Silkwood, just as successful as the investigation that we conducted into the Greensboro killings of the demonstrators down there after they were acquitted by an all-white jury. We convicted them and got over $1 million judgment. Just as clearly as we were able to convince the people at Three Mile Island that there had been a partial meltdown in that core, even after the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had issued a license authorizing the Three Mile Island nuclear facility to pump all the radioactive water in that core out into the Susquehanna River, that we were able to stop. We have been successful. The Christic Institute and now the Romero Institute, which is the Romero Institute because George H.W. Bush, the same night that he issued the pardon of the first six men who were indicted in the Iran-Contra case by Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh, the same night that he issued those pardons, he issued an order to the Internal Revenue Service ordering the revocation of the 501c3 tax-exempt charter of the Christic Institute, saying that our initiating the Iran-Contra case and prosecuting that civil racketeering action against them must have been politically motivated, because no one was ultimately criminally convicted, and that the civil charges that we were making against them in that complaint were all essentially criminal in their nature. The only reason they weren't convicted is because George H.W. Bush pardoned them before there was any trial. And so they revoked our 501c3, and so we then were reborn as the Romero Institute. And that's because, as Danny, we know, that's us now.
Okay, Danny, I want to, you've given us an extraordinarily detailed accounting of the Kennedy assassination. I might add that there was also the work of Edward Curtin, an article in Global Research, Alan Dulles, Indonesian Strategy and the Assassination of John F. Kennedy. He is suggesting in an important book, The Incubus of Intervention, Conflicting Indonesian Strategies of John F. Kennedy and Alan Dulles, that Kennedy, back in November, two days before he was assassinated, which would
November 21st.
Of yeah. November 1963, had accepted an invitation from Indonesian President Sukarno to visit that country the following spring.
Yes.
And the aim of the visit was to end the conflict between Indonesia and Malaysia and to continue Kennedy's efforts to support post-colonial Indonesia with economic and development aid, not military aid.
No.
It was part of this larger strategy of ending conflict throughout Southeast Asia and assisting the growth of democracy in newly liberated post-colonial countries worldwide. And that did not sit with the,
the China lobby.
Brown Brothers
that entire
and
group.
The others who were the top world profiteers at that time. And then
that's
it
right.
went on to talk about how Alan Dulles had secretly been working over in Indonesia, getting with people who had found out how much gold they have, one of the largest gold collections in the world, reserves in the world, and also other natural minerals, oil. They had all that over there, and they wanted to exploit it, and that would have interfered in their agenda, and that was one of the motivating factors. However, leave that aside for the moment.
Yes.
I want you, please, to focus upon Robert Kennedy's assassination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in that, I'd like for you to detail how absolutely corrupt the Los Angeles Police Department has been. The audio of 13 shots, the
yes.
LAPD's destruction of photos and evidence,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Were any of the same people involved in John F. Kennedy's assassination involved in Robert Kennedy's assassination? And then how Sirhan Sirhan was also set up, much like Lee Harvey Oswald, as the patsy. Take it from there, please.
Okay. Now it's important to point out that there's a distinction in my direct involvement in the John Kennedy assassination investigation, in which I had professional criminal investigators working for me in my professional capacity as the director of that investigation, the private investigation from Bailey's firm, and my relationship to the Robert Kennedy assassination. I was just a first-year law student at Harvard Law School when Bobby was killed. I was working with the person who would have been his Secretary of State, Professor Abe Shea, and the man who would have been working as his Secretary of Defense, Adam Yarmolinsky. We were directly involved in trying to talk Bobby into running in 1968 against Lyndon Johnson. So I was intimately involved at that level with him at the time. But when in fact the killing took place, I was at a distance from that, never had an occasion to be drawn into in my official capacity, actually directing a criminal investigation of this. But what I do know is that Paul Schrade, who was a friend of Allard Lowenstein's, whom I knew, and Paul was one of the people that was wounded there in the kitchen with Bobby Kennedy. He was standing, in fact, directly behind Bobby. And he has testified under oath that, in fact, he knows positively that, in fact, Sirhan was never behind Bobby at any time, and Bobby never had his back turned to Sirhan. And the first shot that was fired hit Paul, in fact, hit him in the forehead. But he knows, he remembers vividly the sight of Sirhan standing in front, about 3 to 5 feet in front of Bobby, and then firing the shot that hit Paul. But that Bobby is important to remember. The autopsy the autopsy that was conducted by the L.A. office even acknowledged that Bobby had two bullets in his back just below his right armpit, and then he had one bullet behind his right ear that had gone up into his brain. So all three of the bullets that hit him were fired from behind. And the fact is, the two maitre d's, the assistant maitre d's, Carl Uecker and Edward Messazia, who were in fact leading Bobby Kennedy through the kitchen, saw Sirhan Sirhan, and they saw him fire the first two shots, in that they were in, he was in front of Bobby, and that they say that at no time did Sirhan ever, was he ever behind Bobby, or did Bobby ever turn his back to Sirhan, but that in fact the Carl Uecker tackled, he's the man that tackled Sirhan and drove him down against that that steamer and held and grabbed his gun hand and held the gun and in fact pointed the gun away from, directly away from where Bobby was, so that when Sirhan continued to pull the trigger and shot six more shots that injured Erwin Stroll, a 17-year-old kid, hit him in the leg, and then ABC director William Wiesel hit him in the stomach, and he hit Ira Goldstein in the hip. That those three other people, and it was an artist, Elizabeth Greenens, who was shot, that these other people were hit by wild firing completely in the other direction, away from Bobby. Now, and then, of course, that you referred to the audio recording, the Brzezinski recording, they referred to it as, and John Kent, Robert Kennedy Jr. Actually sent a letter to Eric Holder in 2012 insisting that Eric Holder reinvestigate this and to review the Brzezinski audio that shows the 13 shots, but Holder did nothing about this. And nobody did anything about the fact that the LAPD ballistics expert, a man by the name of Larry Baggett, he in fact has testified under oath that the bullets that were taken from Bobby Kennedy's armpit, in fact, were not fired by Sirhan's gun. He did the official ballistics for the LA Police Department. But the fact of the matter is, as you've referred to it, on August 21st of 1968, just after the June 5th shooting, and on August 28th of 1968, the Los Angeles Police Department burned 2,140 photographs of the crime scene, and they destroyed the door paneling, in which at least two bullets had been removed from the door paneling, and they destroyed the panels. This is absolutely unheard of. And Greg Stone, a professor from the University of Wisconsin, who's another friend of Ellard Loewenstein's, I knew Ellard Loewenstein because I ran, in 1972, I ran George McGovern's Democratic primary campaign in the 14th Congressional District of New York, and Ellard Loewenstein was there in the 14th CD running against John Rooney for the Democratic Party nomination for the Congress. So that's how I met Allard. That's how I know these guys. So I've talked to these people, and it's independently, but it's never been in the capacity as a professional attorney investigating a criminal case or a civil case against the people. But I know, based upon my 45 years of experience, and I might say unique experience in this field in the United States, that a full-scale bona fide investigation, reinvestigation of Bobby Kennedy's assassination, would in fact turn up direct evidence that, if placed in front of a grand jury, would in fact result in having to subpoena additional people to bring them in who, again, still are alive. Some of the people from the Los Angeles Police Department. Somebody needs to testify about why those 2,140 photographs were burned, why the door jams with the bullets in them were destroyed, the ceiling tiles they had other bullet holes in them. This is something that bears extreme investigation. But as I say, I am not in a position to conclude that any additional person was involved. I do know there's a Dr. Marcus McBoom, who in fact has sworn an affidavit saying that he saw a man who was not Sirhan rushing out of the kitchen with a pistol in his hand after the shooting, and he was never called in front of a grand jury. They never, there's been no competent, responsible, professional investigation conducted yet of the Bobby Kennedy assassination either. And it's just the entire political legal system sort of recoils in the face of the possibility that someone other than a lone gunman would have done this. And now, and as you referenced before, there's this very peculiar set of information about the state of mind of Sirhan Sirhan and his conducting himself in a manner that is uncomfortably consistent with a person who has been subjected to post-hypnotic suggestion. But again, I have no direct personal information on that, only because I've never been retained and I've never had the direct capacity to interrogate people, to subject them to psychological stress evaluators, to have access to the information. But I can tell you that this investigation bears a redoing of the Bobby Kennedy assassination. But I know perfectly well that with regard to the John F. Kennedy assassination, direct indictments, criminal indictments and convictions could be obtained still against people who are still alive today. And that may not be true of the Bobby Kennedy assassination. And just parenthetically, I would point out that I think that there's circumstantial evidence that would indicate that there was, or at least other people potentially involved in the shooting of Bobby, the so-called woman in the polka dot skirt, and this man that Dr. Marcus McBoom saw running from the kitchen. But that does not necessarily link then to, in fact, any of the high-level people that were involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. There is the one person, however, James Braden. Now, this is the only link that I know about personally, that James Braden is a man who was within minutes of the assassination of President Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963, was stopped and taken into custody by the Dallas Police Department coming out of the Hunt building, the Hunt office building, which was immediately behind President Kennedy. That, remember, when President Kennedy was going down Elm Street, down that slope, the book depository was looming up to his right, up over his right shoulder. But directly behind him was the Hunt office building. And this man, James Braden, was stopped coming out of the Hunt office building, and he lied. He gave a false name for who he was, and they know that he was earlier that morning in the law office of the attorney that represented Jack Ruby. And James Braden was stopped on June 5th of 1968 at the hotel. At the hotel in Los Angeles, he was stopped out front of the hotel and taken into custody and questioned, and then was released. So James Braden was at the scene in both of those assassinations, and that's all we know at this time. And I've had long discussions with Peter Dale Scott, with lots of other people that have been involved in researching this. And I know that the research community and the professional legal community are in a capacity to be able to conduct a thorough professional investigation of this if the resources were made available.
Well, so that, Danny, let me tell you what I know concerning Robert F. Kennedy's assassination. I spent a lot of time with Robert Blair Kaiser,
yes,
who wrote the definitive book on Robert F. Kennedy and the Sirhan Sirhan. And he had documentation, and he even brought in a psychiatrist. And what he would do when he was under hypnosis, he would state, pay to the order of Sirhan, Sirhan, blank, 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 pay to the order over and over again.
Mm-hmm,
and that
was
post-hypnotic suggestion. And it led the psychiatrist, the forensic psychiatrist, to believe that he had been put under hypnosis and he had been influenced to be a part of the assassination. He'd been set up, and he would be paid a certain amount of money because he kept saying the same thing over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to get distracted with that for the moment.
Yes, yes.
I want to go back to Jack Ruby.
Yes.
Because he was instrumental in all this, because he's the one who killed
Oswald.
He's the one who killed Lee Harvey Oswald. Tell us what you know about Jack Ruby.
Oh, gee, there's a lot to be known about Jack Ruby. Jack Ruby, as we know, was the owner and manager of the Carousel Club in Dallas. And the Carousel Club, there were lots of people in the Dallas Police Department who hung out at the Carousel Club and, quote, dated some of the women that were the bar girls and stuff there at the Carousel. And, in fact, two different witnesses placed Lee Harvey Oswald there at the Carousel Club in the presence of Jack Ruby, and they place J.D. Tippit, the police officer that was shot in Dallas that same afternoon after the president was shot, which was the crime for which Lee Harvey Oswald was actually picked up and originally interrogated, not for the killing of President Kennedy, but for the alleged killing of J.D. Tippit. And the bottom line is that the Carousel Club was a place where people that had connections to organized crime were involved. And it all the investigation that we've conducted of that indicates that Jack Ruby was, in fact, the bag man to the Dallas Police Department for the mafia. And that he was, that his principal was actually Sam Giancana out of Chicago. And that the gambling interest and narcotics interest and stuff around Dallas, that Jack Ruby functioned as a bag man for them. And what we do know is that Jack Ruby insisted upon meeting with Earl Warren when the Warren Commission was conducting the reinvestigation of the assassination, and Ruby kept asking Earl Warren, please, get me out of this jail, get me to Washington, and I will tell you the truth about all of this. And Earl Warren refused to have him come to Washington, refused to have him testify at all. And then Jack Ruby died incarcerated of some strange, very fast-acting cancer and died. But no one ever got him, no one ever chose to interrogate him about this. And so, and he kept on just saying he had on the spur of the moment shot Lee Harvey Oswald because Jack Ruby felt so terrible for poor Jackie Kennedy, how sad it was to see her standing there, you know, with her little baby, her little boy John, you know, at the he just spontaneously ran off and shot Oswald. You know, no one with a professional investigatory IQ above room temperature, you know, would have believed that. And yet there was such an insistence, a uniform insistence on the part of all of the authorities in positions of law enforcement and FBI inside the executive branch from Lyndon Johnson on down to insist that this investigation focus solely and exclusively upon attempting to marshal as much evidence
as they possibly could. We only have 3 minutes left.
Yes.
You mentioned just now something that surprised me, that Officer Tippit was seen with Jack Ruby.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a friend of mine, Robert Morningstar, who's done probably more research on Tippit than anyone else.
Yes.
And also on Kennedy's autopsy.
Yep.
Claims that it was not Lee Harvey Oswald who shot Tippit. Tell us about who your evidence points to on Tippit. And that would mean Tippit, if Tippit was a part of this and then Tippit got taken out.
Yes.
What does that tell you?
Yeah, I can say this. The evidence that was marshaled in that early investigation against Lee Harvey Oswald, asserting that he's the one that killed Tippit, is not at all persuasive. That based on that evidence that he would be acquitted of any involvement in the J.D. Tippit assassination. The fact is there were three eyewitnesses to the shootings. Two of them said absolutely not, that they did not believe that it was Oswald. There was a third woman, the woman Mary something or other, who all she said is that when they brought her in, they put her in front of a lineup with Lee Harvey Oswald in it, and she said that second man from the left, when I look at him, it gives me chills. That's all she ever said. And they said, that's it. Okay, we're holding him on the death of J.D. Tippit. And the fact of the matter is that Mark Lane, whom I knew very well, and that Mark Lane interviewed her later, and she said that the person that she saw shoot J.D. Tippit was short, heavy set and had black, wavy, curly hair. That's clearly not a description of Oswald. And that she reiterated that she had just said that all I said is that this man gives me chills. And it turns out that she had seen Oswald's photograph prior to the lineup. Nobody else identified it. And moreover, there's some extraordinary pieces of information. For example, that at the death scene of J.D. Tippit, they found four empty shell casings on the ground. There were 38 shell casings. And two of them were, I think, Remington. Two of them were Remingtons, and two of them were, what was the other one? And the fact of the matter is, the slugs that were pulled out of J.D. Tippit's body were two Remingtons and only one of the other one. And so the shell casings that were just laying there on the ground, and it's asserted that what happened is the shooter just walked over and opened up the revolver and dumped the shell casings out right there on the side of the road and walked away. And the shell casings did not match the slugs that were taken out of J.D. Tippit's body. That is absolutely astronomical evidence. It's very similar to what happened in the O.J. Simpson case with the alleged bloody socks. When they actually found the bloody socks, and it turns out that the blood on the socks was O.J. Simpson socks found in his bedroom, and the blood on the socks were the blood of his wife, but it turns out that they had formaldehyde in the blood, which showed that is blood that was taken from the crime scene by the police and put in formaldehyde to keep it, and they planted it on the socks. And that was one of the key things that got O.J. Simpson acquitted. Because when you find that kind of manipulation and falsification of evidence by the police inspectors, the whole case falls apart. And it was clear that that happened at the J.D. Tippit death scene. And also, they said they found his wallet. They found Oswald's wallet at the scene. And the fact of the matter is, there are two police officers that have sworn affidavits that they took the wallet out of Oswald's pocket when he was arrested in the theater.
I'll invite Robert Morningstar on to fill that piece, the puzzle of why they would have killed Tippit, who would have killed Tippit. Because Tippit and John F. Kennedy had something in common. I'll save that for another program.
Yeah, Colin
Danny,
Reed.
As always, thank you very much for being on. Danny Sheehan, S-H-E-E-H-A-N. You can reach him at theromeroinstitute.org. And we appreciate very much, Danny, you giving us the insight on the assassinations of the Kennedys and the puppet masters behind them. Thank you very much. I'm Gary Nall for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening.